The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today, Dick Gregerson, this topic, selling the family business. It's a very important part of planning for retirement. In many cases, it means handing on what it is you have built to the people who have come behind you, to your kids. You know, we're going to cover a topic before we get to our guest today that is very important to those of you who are nearing retirement or if you're just retired, and that is protecting your savings and investments from what we know is going to be the next downturn. For many baby boomers, their retirement plans have been delayed, they've been altered, or their lifestyles have been changed as a result of two major bear markets and the policy of financial repression, which has been pursued by the Federal Reserve, which has kept interest rates suppressed for the last 8 years. And even though, at least on a technical basis, the economy has recovered from the Great Recession, economic growth has been anemic, and investment returns have been very hard to come by these last 2 years now that the Fed has ended quantitative easing. When the Fed actually raised interest rates, the economy began to stumble again, and there is truly the risk of another recession ahead with an accompanying bear market. So in a world of zero interest rates, which is what it is for now, in some place it's negative interest rates, it's important that listeners begin to think about protecting their capital, especially now the returns on capital are this low. So today's program is going to be all about preserving capital. Jim, what we need to do before we talk about how to do it, let's frame everything, do the groundwork as to why investors really need to start thinking in defensive terms in the environment in which we find ourselves.
You know, this reminds me of, John, a great quote from sports that I think is appropriate as it pertains to, let's say, the markets right now. And that is, offense wins games, but defense wins championships. And if you think of this year's Super Bowl, where the Denver Broncos defense basically stomped the other side, and they end up winning the championship. And I think that is where investors need to be right now. And especially now that we're seeing the economy slow down, and the risk of another recession is increasing. It's really amazing when you think about it. It was November of 2014 when the last bit of taper ended. So the Fed was no longer providing liquidity to the markets, John. And since that period of time, the stock market has virtually gone nowhere. So it's rather interesting, even though the Fed is still talking about raising interest rates, they keep doing a number of 180s. And they've been doing that. I mean, they started in December. They were going to have 4 rate hikes. Then they had their March meeting, and they nailed that down to 2. And now, as a recent speech, it's implied that maybe they only go once this year. So apparently, the Fed is starting to see something, which we talk about on the weekend program, of an economy that has peaked, and there are a number of indicators that point to that direction. And so that has broad, broad implications for investment portfolios, and especially for somebody that is nearing retirement or maybe just recently retired.
Well, this is an issue we've been discussing on the weekend show about the risk of another recession and a bear market. So what we want to do is, right, so much for that. Let's put this in context of what that signifies for someone who is nearing retirement or for individuals or couples who actually did recently retire. They have to grapple with this, the environment we're in.
One of the biggest investment mistakes made in retirement portfolios is to be highly concentrated in equities, or what we would call risk assets, at the beginning of a retirement. And there's a reason for this. You don't want to be drawing down assets in a market downturn because you're going to be liquidating those assets at a time they're falling in value. So you diminish your assets at an accelerating rate. Now, the typical retirement plans usually come up with a withdrawal rate. In other words, if you have X amount of dollars, and you're going to retire, they're going to say, all right, your distribution or drawdown rate is going to be X percent a year. That's the way most financial plans or retirement plans work. So it might be 3 or 4%. So most assets that people have are invested either in mutual funds or ETFs. So, for example, if we take $1 million portfolio, and let's say you wanted to take a distribution rate of, let's say, 4% a year, technically, you could last for 25 years at that rate, not counting inflation. The problem is, what happens when those assets need to be liquidated? Now, it's not a problem in a bull market where stocks are rising. Where you run into problems, and it could be a disaster, is in a bear market when stocks fall 30 to 45%, as they did, for example, with the bursting of the tech bubble or the Great Recession between 2007 and 2009. Because what you're doing is you're liquidating assets that are declining in value, so you quickly deplete your portfolio. And that is why you should be more conservatively invested at the beginning of your retirement in order to avoid a major drawdown of your assets should we enter another bear market or a recession, which, John, at this point, I think is highly probable.
Yeah, as so, and we've discussed that on the Financial Sense News Hour quite a bit. Now, Jim, are there any guidelines or recommended percentages as to the amount that should be invested in stocks when you retire? And you remember, we've discussed a lot here on lifetime income, the idea that everybody had formula retirement plans. Retirement planners were using these formulas and everybody just got plugged into them. So I imagine that you're going to have to think a little differently.
Well, we're operating in a different environment. I mean, this was brought up by Professor Merton when I interviewed him, just about a month ago, when his new article on the coming crisis in retirement planning. And he really illustrated this, John, by talking about, had you retired in the year 2000, you had $1 million, you could count on getting $70,000 to $80,000 a year income off that $1 million, which is pretty comfortable for most people retired, if you add in Social Security and other types of investments. But you fast forward today, where the 10-year Treasury bond is 1.7%, $1 million only produces $17,000 of income. So you've seen over a 70% drop in the level of income. So there are a number of guidelines that are used in the industry, and they're sort of the norms when you talk about retiring, and they use them. One very popular norm is use your age to allocate a percentage of assets, for example, invested in fixed income or bonds. We tend to use a more targeted approach based on meeting budgetary needs. For example, pairing secure income to match basic budget expenses and more variable type returns to take care of what I call the bucket list or items in a budget like travel and entertainment. Because we find, John, that that works much better than trying to use, quote, a particular percentage, because percentages don't work in practice. It might have worked in another era of time, for example, in the 80s and 90s, when the returns on investments, whether fixed or in the market, were much more predictable, and the returns on fixed income and cash were much higher. I mean, even as far back as 2007, you could have got 5% on a money market fund. Today, you're lucky to get over a quarter of a percent, if that at all. So, you know, things have changed dramatically here. And I think one of the problems that people have is you come up with these standard quotes or these standard percentages. John, they just simply don't work in this kind of environment. And that's why it's very, very important. They did a number of studies on retirement planning success. And what they found, contrary to popular opinion, is you should have less invested in the stock market at the beginning of your retirement and more invested in the stock market towards the end of your retirement. And the reason is you do not want to take a big hit to your retirement portfolio right at the beginning when you first start out. I mean, imagine if you had $1 million in 2008, by the time the bear market was over, stocks were down 45%. What you don't want to do is start out your retirement and take a 40 or 50% hit to your portfolio. And that's why we're talking now, John, it's time to think about getting defensive given the macro environment we're starting to see with the slowdown here in the United States, a slowdown overseas. You've got negative interest rates in Europe and Japan. The emerging markets are in trouble right now. And we also have, you know, stocks aren't as cheap as they were, let's say, 6-7 years ago. And we're also in an environment where the economy is a lot more leveraged, which is one reason I don't think the Fed is going to get anywhere near close to what it thinks it's going to be able to do in raising interest rates without collapsing the economy into another recession.
Well, as I mentioned before on the weekend show, we've talked a lot about the approaching recession and bear market. Now, let's create a case here where you have investors, they're close to retirement or even recently retired, about the same stage of life. If they don't want to find themselves depleting their assets, they've got to have a plan to deal with this.
You know, it's interesting because this week, the Wall Street Journal did an article thinking about a approaching bear market and recession. And it was really how much you should have invested in stocks as an investor. Now, obviously, we're in the seventh year of a bull market, but this bull market is getting rather old. What we know now is from just looking at evidence, corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014, and the economy, in terms of economic growth rates, has also peaked. So we know that within probably the next year or so, could be longer, we could find ourselves in another recession. This was the issue addressed in the Wall Street Journal article, and it really wanted to get at how much should you be invested in stocks? And as the journal pointed out, the percentage in stocks depends on, number one, the size of the portfolio, number two, your age, and number three, how close you are to your retirement. Now, the range for investing in stocks, and it's a wide range, believe it or not, from 0 to 100%, with in-between percentages based on risk and age of 30, 50%. All those percentages, John, were based on, obviously, asset size, your age, and then, of course, your own risk tolerance. Some people may not be able to tolerate risk. Others are more prone to taking risk and feel comfortable with it. So it was rather interesting when you took a look at what they were trying to get at is how different people with different assets and different age look at the markets much differently in terms of their risk profile and the amount that they should be investing in stocks.
If we have to delineate these percentages, what do they look like?
I mean, let's start as the journal did, they start with the very rich. Now, very wealthy investors have a luxury that other investors don't. They can turn to, for example, cash preservation approach earlier than their less affluent peers. They have the luxury to be able to afford to protect their assets they've accumulated during a downturn. So they don't have to take the risk. They can say, you know what? Things are looking uncertain in the markets. It looks like the economy is not doing well. I'm going to protect my assets. I have enough assets to live on. I don't have to worry about what kind of returns I'm going to get in order to meet my monthly expenses. So they don't have to take on the risk. They have enough to live on, which is really important. But what was interesting is it's not only the very rich who can afford to do this. Investors who have saved very carefully and are able to live frugally can also afford to limit their risk as well. But, you know, the whole purpose of the article, which is what we're trying to get at today, is we've had two major bear markets here in the last decade. And each of those bear markets saw stocks go down 45% more, depending on where you're invested. Like, for example, the NASDAQ was down 70% during the tech downturn. And that is not the kind of position you want to find yourself in after two bear markets, as we discussed, for example, in last week's case study, heading into the next downturn, especially if you're drawing down assets. In other words, you're liquidating shares on a, let's say, a monthly basis to get your check. In other words, you're not relying strictly on, let's say, interest and dividends, because it'd be pretty hard to get 4% today, although that's still possible if you're doing individual stocks and bonds. But most people have their money invested in mutual funds, and they draw down those assets on a monthly basis. Stock market going up, no problem. Stock market going down, as happened in 2007 and 2009, that means every single month you're liquidating shares to live on, but you're liquidating those shares at lower prices, which is one reason why I think, you know, John, we really need to start thinking about capital preservation.
Okay, what about others? People who are less fortunate, maybe they're close to retirement with very low risk tolerances.
You know, for those with low risk tolerances, according to the article, in our, let's say, closer to retirement, the percentage in stocks is roughly around 30%, with the balance invested in cash and short-term bonds. Now, the closer you are to retirement, the lower the percentage should be in stocks. Now, for investors who are what I would call in the middle age group, let's say late 30s, 40s, that percentage is probably 50%, 50% in stocks, 50% in bonds. You're basically reducing your risk by creating this balance between stocks and bonds. Typically in a market downturn, bonds do well. But you're not completely out of stocks because you still have time working on your side. For example, take a look at the market recoveries from 2002 to 2007, where the stock market was up several hundred percent. And likewise, when the market recovered after the downturn of 2008 and 2009, between 2009 and 2015, the stock market was up over several hundred percent. So great market returns, you don't want to miss out on the run-up when another bull market begins. So if you're middle-aged, you've got probably another 20, 25 years working for you before you retire. You can afford to have a higher percentage in the stock market.
All right, what about younger investors, say people in their 20s, the 30s? The percentage of stocks is closer to 100%. So how do they do in this type of an environment?
You know, this is where dollar cost averaging really works for a young person. I mean, you think of somebody starting out at age 25 and they work for a company, they have a 401k plan. Every single month, they put money into that 401k plan. Actually, you really want to have market downturns because, let's take, for example, the market downturn of 2007 to 2009. Now, in September of 2007, the stock market peaked and went down just about every single month until the market bottomed in March of 2009. Now, if you're a young person and every single month you're putting $100, let's say, into your 401k plan, and let's just give you a hypothetical example. Let's say you're investing in a S&P index fund and it's $10 a share. Okay, at the peak of the market, your share value is $10. Let's say a year later, the market's down 20% and now those shares are selling for $8. Well, that $100 you're putting in on a monthly basis is buying a lot more shares at $8 or $7 or $6 than it, let's say you were when the stock market was going up and the shares were selling at $10. And really all you care 30, 45 years from now is how many shares you're going to own. And you're going to accumulate more shares in a market downturn. And this is why, you know, staying invested in stocks, especially when you're at an early age in your 20s and 30s, really plays out, because the stock market is a great wealth creation machine.
All right. So given the fact that we do expect another recession and bear market coming up just ahead, investors are looking for advice. What would you advise them?
You know, I think a lot depends, as we've discussed here, on the size of assets and how close you are to retirement, but it's definitely time to start getting defensive and think of protecting capital, which is what we've been doing, for example, our clients since last fall. Now, we've moved into short-term bonds, normally in the 1 to 2 year maturity range, because as an economy begins to slow down and as you head into a recession, what happens is there's a greater risk, especially if you're investing in bonds. So what happens is investors begin to demand a higher interest rate, especially on corporate bonds, to compensate for the risk of a company going into an economic downturn. Obviously, when you're in a recession, sales drop off for a company, profits are cut back, and there's a greater risk there. So we expect that we're going to see rising interest rates. We saw that happen last year as the economy began to weaken, as we saw credit spreads. And this is something we watch rather closely between, let's say, sovereign debt like treasuries, which on the day we're doing this interview, a 10-year treasury has a yield of 1.7%. And you look at junk bonds that are over 8%, corporate bonds are over 4%. So that's one thing that we're doing right now. We're beefing up our bond portfolio as a method of defense. The other thing is, even though we own stocks, our stock allocation has been reduced, and the kind of stocks we own are more defensive in nature, such as staples, telecoms, utilities, or high dividend paying stocks where the yields are high enough between the 3 and 4% range. And lastly, we're doing something that we call takeover arbitrage, which is like a short-term bond position. And we're basically buying companies that are being taken out for cash and parking that money there. And, you know, for a couple months, you sit there and you hold the stock. The stock is fairly stable because the company's getting taken out for cash, not for stock. And then, of course, when the takeover comes, you get the full value of the takeover amount that was agreed upon. But we've been in a de-risking mode since last fall. And believe it or not, the other asset, as we've talked about on our weekend show that we're looking at, is gold as a hedge against financial risk. We talked on the weekend about the percentage of defaults are increasing, that this time around in the next downturn, we could see a 14% default rate, especially on low quality bonds. Also, as a protection against financial repression and negative interest rates, in an environment which, John, gold generally does rather well when the carrying cost is actually positive for gold compared to cash, where like in Europe or Japan, the carrying cost of cash is actually negative.
Okay, now what about cash in the role of a defense asset or mechanism?
You know, I'm not big on cash right now, other than something that's going to be deployed, because in this kind of environment, there's very little return on cash. I would prefer to be in short-term bonds in the 1 to 2 year range, where we can pick up yields of 3 to 4%, which is obviously much better than a 0.5% or maybe 1% on cash. And there's also the risk of bail-ins in the next financial crisis. And this is something investors really need to pay a lot of attention, because the SEC has rolled out new rules on money market funds where they can break the buck this year. And also, we saw this happen in Greece and Cyprus when the banks went under. Those that had large deposits in those banks were left not getting all their money back. And John, you've seen this in the political campaign. Taxpayers aren't going to bail out Wall Street or the banks again. This time around, depositors are going to be on the hook. There just isn't a mood in this country for any more bailouts. You can see this in, for example, the Bernie Sanders campaign, and even among some of the Republicans talking about no more bailouts. The banks and Wall Street are persona non gratis in this presidential election.
Let me pose you a different scenario here, Jim. What about individuals, say they have a lot in bonds right now, or I know one case is going to be where a lot of people are just stuck in 401k plans. What do they do in this environment as they near retirement?
You know, a lot of companies have what is called a 401k in-service rollover, and that is because a lot of 401k programs, John, there's a limitation in terms of what you can do. They're usually mutual funds. They've got a couple stock funds, a couple international funds, a couple bond funds, and maybe a money market fund. That's pretty much it. And you have to choose between those. If you want to get more specific, a lot of companies are offering individuals who are close to retirement something called an in-service 401k rollover. And that is, let's say, you know, you're working for a company, been there 20 years or so. You've got, I don't know, let's say $500,000 in your 401k program. They allow you to roll that 401k program into an IRA rollover. You still continue to contribute to your 401k program, but the bulk of your assets are rolled over into an IRA, where you have a lot more leeway and flexibility to do the kind of things that we're talking about here that are more defensive in nature versus basically being stuck with, you know, a handful of 401k options, which is usually what you see in most 401k programs. But they're basically 401k in-service rollovers. And if you're 5 years away from retirement, 3 years away from retirement, you ought to check with your personnel department if you have that option, so that you can get your assets more into a safe environment, especially if you're considering retiring anytime soon.
All right. If we put all of this together just as an action item, number one, start taking your chips off the table. Number two, very important to start thinking defensively at this time. Number three, the closer you get to retirement, the more defensive you should be. And number four, you can't afford a major drawdown. So that's the goal that you're trying to avoid. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Dick Gregerson is going to be our guest, selling the family business. Family businesses are the backbone of much of the economy. And when you try to pass on what you have earned and built up during your lifetime to your children, selling the business and doing something with those assets is a very important consideration. Let's go to our lifetime case study, which we do every week, that illustrates the subjects we have been discussing today. Of course, what do you do in the current environment as you near retirement? The case studies are real life studies. They're actual people. We simply change the names to protect the privacy. So what does the case look like this week, Jim?
Well, we're going to call this the case of Jim and his wife, Millis. Jim is age 66. His wife, Millis, is 64. Jim was forced to retire. His wife, basically a stay-at-home mom. Now, their expenses during retirement are estimated to be roughly about $85,000. Several income sources, current income sources are $33,000 from Jim's Social Security and $43,000 in loan payments from their two sons' real estate investments. They are fortunately debt-free. Their total net worth is roughly about $2.8 million. And their investable assets are $1.5 million. Now, here's the way their assets were broken out. They had $200,000 in a fixed annuity in an IRA. And unfortunately, they were sold a high surrender annuity. So there's still 6 years left in surrender charges. So that was basically an asset that was going to stay put. They had $1.2 million, which was invested in the IRA rollover, about $70,000 in bank accounts, roughly about 1 year's worth of living expenses. Investments in real estate, roughly about $828,000. They gave loans to sons for rental properties, and they're a partial owner of rental homes. They receive roughly about $43,000 a year income from the loan repayment from their sons, and their primary residence, roughly about $550,000. Now, Jim was with another advisor or broker, and things got a little scary for him, especially during the market downturn in 2008. Unfortunately, though, he moved a lot of his assets. He left that advisor, went to manage investments on his own, and put about 22% of his assets, at one time was actually larger, in bullion and junior miners. 30% of his assets were in cash, and then he had 12% in small mid-cap stocks, 22% in large-cap stocks, and a small percentage in bonds. Now, his background is he's an engineer by trade, and he was let go by his company last year due to the downturn in energy. Now, given his age, 66, and industry constraints, he hasn't been able to find another position and has been forced into retirement. And once again, we've seen this happen so often, John, as a result of the Great Recession, where a lot of people had plans they were thinking about, you know, I'm going to retire at this age, at this time, and then all of a sudden, the downturn comes, and look at what's happening to the energy industry. Even though the economy is not in a recession, the energy economy is in a recession. In Jim's case, he lost his job. So given his age and the constraints, when he came to us, basically he wanted professional management because emotionally he came to the realization that he did not make investment decisions very well, tended to make him more from an emotional point of view rather than, let's say, an analytical point of view. So he didn't want to manage his own assets. The investment objective, basically, as anybody starting out in retirement, was to preserve wealth and maintain purchasing power. Some of the things that we looked at is a lot of the assets are tied up in his IRA and real estate, low cash, and no taxable accounts. The trust we found was not updated, and the investment properties were held in personal names, so that created a liability and also a probate issue for him. And given where his assets were allocated, given the fact that he was now retired, it was far too aggressive and did not align with risk tolerance, especially with his wife, Millis, and their investment objectives. So what we recommended was a balanced approach where we had a large percentage in bonds, especially short-term corporate bonds, because what we wanted to do is reduce the risk and create more predictability. And we also shaved his precious metals position down to 10%. 22% was way too high for somebody that's retired. We began to make Roth conversions, since not using IRA as income had several years until he had to take mandatory distributions. This would diversify his tax base of assets and lower future taxes, and he could get several hundred thousand into a Roth IRA before age 70 and a half. Because at age 66, with $1.2 million in his IRA, and actually $1.4 million when we, let's say, count the annuity, that $1.4 million could be, you know, close to $1.6, $1.8 million when he would have to begin mandatory distributions, which would put him in a high tax bracket combined with the Social Security and the $43,000 he was getting in loan repayments from his real estate. We reduced exposure to risky assets like small cap, mid cap, and emerging markets. And we basically, John, created a more conservative portfolio, corporate bonds, large cap dividend paying stocks. We updated the estate plan, including putting the assets into the trust, because the trust basically is property titling, bypassed his will in his estate planning, because property titling takes precedent over, let's say, a will or trust. And the other thing that we did is, as an engineer, he basically wanted to know how things were done, in other words, how money was managed. And so we have a quarterly newsletter that we put out, and then also other forms of communication, which made him feel more comfortable because, as he mentioned, he tends to make his investments more from an emotional point of view. And what we pointed out, and he was in agreement, is that in the next 12 to 18 months, we were likely to head into a recession and a bear market. And he could attest to that because he got laid off in the energy industry, which is in a recession. So getting defensive fit into basically more of where he wanted to be starting his retirement, since it came unexpectedly. He thought he would be working another 3 or 4 years, basically almost up to age 70. Well, obviously, with what's happened to the price of oil and energy, things turned out much, much different. But anyway, now more aligned with risk aversion, and also for somebody that's beginning their retirement.
And coming up next, Dick Gregerson, selling the family business, what you have to be thinking about when you do it as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, the heart of the American economy is small business. But there's a problem when it comes to retirement. A lot of small businesses owned by single individuals. What does an individual do when the bulk of their net worth is tied up in the business itself? Where does the liquidity come from for retirement, or for that matter, estate taxes? Joining us on the program is Dick Gregerson, president at Janus Consulting. And you know, Dick, one of the things that you see in this country that has made it great is these small businesses that start up, whether it's, you know, Steve Jobs and Wozniak working out of a garage, turning into a company like Apple. You know, the great thing about that is eventually it becomes a public company. But a lot of businesses in this country are family-owned, owned by a single individual, or maybe it's a partnership, and it's not a public corporation. So what do you do? For example, let's say, you know, I'm 65. I think I want to retire. I don't have heirs, or if I do have heirs, they don't have an interest in the business. What does an individual do to get that liquidity and be able to retire and basically take out all that blood and sweat that built the business?
Fortunately, you're living in the United States, and we have many, many more options than a lot of other places in the world. There are a variety of different kinds of buyers and deal structures that you can consider in selling the company. There are financial institutions called private equity groups that collect money from wealthy individuals and endowments, and they're out looking for companies to buy and to cultivate and grow. A vast majority of companies get sold to other larger corporations that are looking for increased market share or new products, new ideas, those kinds of things. And there's an area that many people overlook is that if you have a strong person in your company, there's an opportunity perhaps to either sell the company to that individual in a management buyout or perhaps to all of your employees in a tax advantage structure called an ESOP. But all of these alternatives really need to be considered in the context of what your personal goals are, when you want to retire, how you want to retire, do you want to work for a little while longer, and need to consider that in as part of your overall plan of your estate planning and taxes and those kinds of things, because you're going to suddenly go from hopefully being both cash rich and company rich, but for a lot of these entrepreneurs, you put everything back into the company. You're going to have, you know, some fairly sizable taxes that you're going to need to pay upon sale, and also you're going to be selling the most important product that you've ever sold, which is your lifetime creation, the company that you built and that you run, and you need to think about how you present that company so that it becomes attractive to other parties.
Now, when you're talking about these businesses, I imagine, Dick, is there a difference between, let's say, a sizable business, a $50 million business, a $100 million business versus, let's say, a $5 or $10 million difference? Are there different strategies given the size of the business?
There are. The smallest businesses, which would be companies where the owner is making less than $1 million of pre-tax earnings, typically gets listed and sold through business brokers. And those are often made up of a lot of Main Street kinds of companies, as well as small specialty manufacturers and service companies. Once you get over $1 million in cash flow earnings, your business starts to become attractive both to larger corporations and to institutional investors. And the larger the company gets, the more valuable it gets relative to its earnings and the sales as well. And the reason for that is that the smaller the business, typically the more dependent it is on the individual owner. And the new buyer has to feel highly confident that if they pay a premium for the company, that your key employees and your customer relationships and your know-how will be transferred. Well, in a larger corporation where you have many levels of management, a lot of that customer relationship and know-how and product development are spread out in various different layers and departments versus, say, a small manufacturing company where you're turning out product and you're both the salesperson, the chief financial officer, and the bottle washer. As a result of that, the companies that are much larger tend to sell for a much higher multiple of revenues and are, in generally speaking, more saleable. Statistically speaking, for companies that are in the business broker size, about 1 in 5 of them find buyers. For businesses that sell for between $5 million and $50 million in an average economy, 1 in 3 will find buyers. They're represented by an investment bank or a broker. That probability increases to somewhere between 50 or 60% or even better than that. For companies that are over $100 million in value, it isn't a question as to whether or not they'll find a buyer. It's really more of a question of whether or not they're going to maximize their value.
And what about the tax advantages? Because we know that if you've started a business and you sell it and you have long-term capital gains, depending on how valuable that business is, the tax rates here could be as much as 23.8% plus any state taxes. What can be done to minimize, and is it easier to minimize the taxes the larger the company? For example, like let's say I own a C corporation. It's fortunate enough that it's worth $50 to $100 million. Well, if I exchange and sell my company in exchange for stock with a public company, there is no tax on the sale of that company until I sell the shares. What about businesses that are smaller? How do you minimize taxes?
Well, two ways. One is if you're a C corp, you'll want to sell the stock of the company rather than the assets to avoid the double taxation. There is no long-term capital gain inside of most corporations, and so you get taxed on the gain on sale, and then the cash that you distribute out to shareholders also gets a dividend tax on top of it. And so that's something that you definitely want to avoid that can help with that. But for other companies, you can defer taxes by receiving some of the payment in terms of a note or a seller earnout so that it gets taxed on an installment sale. And what many owners who are, say, in their 60s and thinking about retiring in a few years, one fairly popular option is to sell out 60 or 80% of the company to a private equity firm, take back a note and continue to have some ownership, and then sell the rest of it when you're ready to retire back to that private equity firm. And so you're selling the company and taking your safe money off the table. You're continuing to receive a salary for the next 4 or 5 years. You have a lot of money behind you to go out and try to grow the company for a final spurt, and then you sell it at a higher valuation 4 or 5 years hence. You don't avoid the taxes, but you do spread that out. And in many cases, what owners have found is that by taking this particular approach, they get as much money on the last 20% as they got on the first 80% that they sold.
Is there anything, Dick, that should be done prior to, let's say, an individual thinking of disposing of his business, whether it's small or large? In other words, setting up the company in a certain type, whether it's a C corp, a sub S corp, are there any things in the planning mode that one should do to set themselves up to dispose of their business in the most favorable manner possible?
Well, the first place to start is with, where is this stock being held? What's the ownership position there? What are you doing for your estate? And have you put it into trusts and generation skipping and those kinds of options that are out there? In terms of the structure of the company, if you have 4 or 5 years before you want to sell the company and it's somehow it wound up being in a C corp, unless there's a special reason to be a C corp, you should probably do an S corp election. And I believe the tax rules are now that if you've been a S corp for 5 years, that you won't have to experience the double taxation that you'd have in the C corp situation. And then on top of that, there are a number of things that you can do to enhance the value of the company. As we said, one of the reasons why larger companies sell for more money than smaller companies is the lack of confidence that under new ownership that the company will do as well. And one of the ways in which to significantly enhance the value of your company and to impress people with the idea that, in fact, you are serious about selling is to upgrade your accounting. Getting an audit speaks volumes about your confidence in the business. I know a lot of owners don't want to spend the money for an audit. They see it as being unnecessary, but for the buyer, it makes it a lot easier for them to obtain financing, and it gives them additional level of confidence that the information that they've received is complete and in a form that they understand under the accounting rules. And I think that finally, the thing that we find in our consulting practice and kind of the reason why we exist is that every owner out there that we've met, there's something that they haven't done so they can sleep at night. You know, after you have trouble making payroll and first few times and you've launched some new products and hired some people and some have worked out and some haven't, there are certain products that maybe you haven't gone after, certain markets you haven't gone after, certain employees you haven't brought on board, pieces of equipment that you haven't invested in, because you have a very nice lifestyle. Maybe your business is making $2-3 million a year for you and you've adjusted your lifestyle to that. And the idea of taking additional risks is just, you're too old for that. You did that when you were younger and didn't always work out. Taking some of those risks in the last few years running up to the sale of the company does two things for you. One is that it adds to your company in terms of size and hopefully the profitability of the company by taking some of the things that maybe you haven't done but could generate some fairly near-term kinds of results, say starting to sell to Walmart if you hadn't sold to Walmart. Those kinds of things. What that does is that if two or three of these things work out and your earnings go from 2 to 3 million to 4 to 5 million, not only are you going to have a larger earning base to sell to the buyer, but you're also going to start showing an upward trend in the business. And the upward trend in the business gives the buyer confidence that going forward, that not only is this a good company, but there's some untapped potential that maybe they can work on in the future.
You know, Dick, what about a situation where, you know, let's say you take a healthy individual, things are going well with the business is generating good cash flow, you got a very comfortable life, but we all know that life is full of surprises. You can see dramatic changes in the business as we saw in the downturn in 2008 and 2009, or something happens health-wise that suddenly changes everything. We're talking about disposing of business when somebody's nearing retirement. But don't you think, or wouldn't you advise, that a lot of these steps that we're talking about here should be taken well in advance of thinking about retirement, just in case something comes up, in case there's a downturn coming in the economy? But in other words, you don't want to be caught off guard when something happens in your personal life or in the economy that you weren't prepared for.
You're absolutely right. If you look back over the years, I know that when I was younger, I thought that good times were normal and the difficult times were the anomaly. And I guess in youth, you have plenty of time to wait for, you know, the next upturn for whatever it is you're planning on doing. Now that I look back on it, I realize that, you know, there's some strong markets out there during certain times. So, for instance, in mergers and acquisitions on a worldwide basis, 2015 was a record year for M&A worldwide and a record year in the United States. And 2013 and 2014 were very good years as well. But if you had to retire in 2009 or 10 because of health reasons, or you passed away and left your estate and they had to sell the company, you just probably wouldn't have found a buyer. So I think that there's two aspects to this. One is that if you're thinking about selling in the next several years, that now would be a good time to go to market. Maybe you sell a part of the business, but one way or the other, you create a situation where you sold the company or have made plans to sell the company in a way that allows you to, regardless of what happens, that you have your safe money and your family is taken care of. So what we're finding this year is that a lot of people have gotten spooked by the volatility in the Asian market. And during the last couple of years, they felt, well, I don't need to sell now because things are going along pretty good. Everything seems to be pretty much fine. I'm not yet 65. We're now finding a number of owners that are coming in and saying, what can we do to get my company on the market and take this money out of that business and put it in the bank in dollars and cents? And yet I don't want to retire. I want to continue on working. And it turns out that what a lot of owners don't understand is that both the institutional investors, the private equity companies, as well as many of the corporations, don't want to buy smaller businesses unless the owner is willing to work for several years. And your willingness to continue on work for someone else can add rather significantly. I mean, it can increase the value of your business by 50% from what it would be like if you decided, I'm going to wait till I'm 65, I'm going to sell into whatever the market is, and I'm going to walk away from the business. That statement, I'm going to walk away from the business, can make the difference between a premium price and just kind of an average price.
Dick, let's take another situation, whether it's a small business or large business. But let's say in this case, the individual has children that he would like to pass the business on to. Let's say there's children that are working in the business. So he wants to pass on this legacy. Two things that strike me. Number one, depending on the value of the business, is there's always estate taxes, because if a business has a value, the government wants to look at that value at death. So whether it's a large corporation where the family is run, or there's heirs that are going to be taking over that business, or it's a small business, what about succession plans with, let's say, your own family? What are the things that you see or recommend that should be done there?
Well, you know, some of us are great savers and planners and accumulate enough money to retire without having to depend upon the sale of the business to pay for that. But the vast majority of business owners haven't had that luxury, particularly after all the difficulties that we've been through in 2007, 8, 9, and 10. And so most owners who want to pass things along to their children need to have some money to live off of. And so selling a part or all of the company, particularly selling enough of it to your heirs so that the remaining value of the company doesn't subject you to a large estate tax, is probably a pretty good strategy. And right now is a good time to do that, because there are, on the smaller deals, say buying out a business worth $10 million or less, there are a number of lenders that are willing to back your children in terms of paying for part or all of that company. For larger transactions, those kinds of deals are very much favored by private equity investors, their theory being that by having your children buy the company, from their standpoint as an investor, you may have sold the company, but you're not going to let your kids fail. And so their risk in paying you a premium for the company it's a lot easier for them to pull the trigger on it, knowing that, you know, you're still going to be there to give junior some advice when they run into a problem that they haven't encountered and you know how to solve that. But not putting that kind of stuff together does a couple of things. One is that from a psychological standpoint and a management standpoint, you need to give your kids the time and the freedom to be able to establish themselves managing the company and taking on real responsibility and stepping into your shoes, because there's a financial aspect to this, but there's also a managerial and psychological aspect to it as well. And that's something that you'd be best served by giving them that real responsibility and really stepping away from the business as part and parcel of this buyout. And we found that having your children borrow money from the bank and buy out a portion of your ownership, and at the same time handing over the reins for maybe it's a set of product lines or maybe it's a divisional office or whatever the scope is of their activity, that coupling those two things together are transformative and really take the first giant step of transferring that ownership both in financial terms and in managerial terms to your children.
So as we sort of sum up here, Dick, depending on the size of the business, depending on your age or whether you have heirs that can carry it on, this should be part of your business plan. And don't just think of, well, that's something I'll do when I get to 65 and closer to retirement, because there are a number of things that can change family-wise, health-wise, in the economy. What would you recommend an individual do that has a business like that? And let's say they're, I don't know, maybe 5 years, 10 years out from retirement. What are the steps they should do? Contact somebody like yourself, contact an advisor, and start putting a plan into effect. What would you advise?
The sale of the business and your transition into retirement is one of the biggest projects you're ever going to undertake. And it literally touches every aspect of your life. Most business owners, their business is their life. They have breakfast with their vendors. They take their customers out to dinner. They're available to the business 7 days a week. So you really need to first start with two plans. One plan is, what can I do to enhance the value of my company? And what are those things that I can implement to make it so it's easier to sell? Maybe there's some new products or projects or things like that that you can do that would significantly enhance that value. And the other side of it is your estate planning side. How can I transfer this wealth down to my children at the lowest possible cost? How can I defer taxes on the sale of the company and then eventually on the estate? And then how am I going to make money after I've retired? And that's perhaps one of the biggest questions that we find with our sellers as they get to the end of the process and they say, gosh, I'm going to have all this money. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. Where should I invest it? What should I do with it? I know I'm comfortable having it in my company, but many of them haven't thought through, what are they going to do? They go from having $1 million into their IRA to having $20 million after tax after they sold their business. And so thinking about that in advance and starting to make plans along those lines so that you wind up with the kind of investments that you want and you're exposed to the kinds of opportunities that are going to help you in your post-retirement life.
Well, listen, Dick, as we close, if our listeners, maybe there's somebody listening to this program that is in that situation, maybe they're 5-10 years away from retirement, or they want to retire now, but they're trying to find or think about issues of which they can monetize that business, if they wanted to contact you, how could they do so?
Please give us a call at 626-432-7000 or visit our website, janusconsulting.com. And you can learn more about the company and our various advisors and get in contact with us directly.
Well, listen, Dick, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. I want to thank you for coming on, and please come back and talk to us again.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, selling the family business is something a lot of people don't think about. You know, if you have a lot of megabucks, it depends on the size of the business. And sometimes it's easier to make these conversions to either sell the business or to hand it off to your kids. The smaller mom and pop shop businesses, a lot of times aren't thinking about this, and they don't know what to do, and it's much more difficult to do because of a more limitation in resources. Also, the same thing you were talking about earlier in the program when we were discussing where we are in the environment today, and people now are puttering along. They're not considering where the next bumps are going to be and what it's going to look like when we get there and what they need to do with their investments. So, which is normally the case. That's why the wise investor is always prepared, always looking ahead. It's like when I used to fly a lot, the instructor always used to tell me, you have to stay three moves ahead of the airplane. You know, always stay ahead of the airplane. Where it is right now, where are you going to be, and what will you need to do when you get there? And that's what you need to be thinking about for retirement.
We're emphasizing getting defensive here, John. And the reason being, as we discussed last week, shortchanged in retirement, where we talk about women that have gotten hit because, number one, the number of years spent out of the workforce, and number two, the Great Recession that really put a dent in a lot of people's portfolios. Now, we've had two of those in a decade. You don't want to get caught up in another downturn like that, especially if you're heading into retirement, where you're going to have to start drawing down those assets. And so that's why it's really key. It's interesting, because what works well in retirement, John, intuitively, is not the way we think about retirement. We think about, you know, maybe more assets in stocks when you retire, less assets as you get older, when studies have shown it's just the opposite. You actually want to have less invested in stocks when you begin your retirement, because you don't want to go through a major downturn in retirement, which has happened to a lot of people that got caught up in that downturn between 2007 and 2009, where not only people lost their jobs, but also they lost a substantial portion of their assets during the great downturn. And a lot of investment mistakes were made where they stayed out of the market. They didn't ride the upturn. So now that the economy is beginning to weaken again and the stock market is becoming more vulnerable, it really is time to think of being defensive if you are closer to retirement. Well, in the meantime, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.